the meeting of the Legacy Division of the House of Representatives and call the meeting to order. The first item we have today is a presentation of the Legacy Plan, 10 to 25 years, by Cortland Nelson. We're running through today our recommendations and requests from various groups, a little bit shorter than it was yesterday.
Let's make sure. No.
Wait till the technology catches up with us. Well, Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm Cortland Nelson, Director of DNR Parks and Trails, and I've got the privilege of presenting to you a short summary of our Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, and I'm going to run through that with you here in the next few minutes and to give you all a sense of what the assignment was, the document that we have completed, and the implications that we believe are in that for our new opportunities that are ahead of us with the Legacy Fund. You may or may not recall that the Legacy Plan is a result of the legislation from 2010, which directed us to create a long-term plan for the Parks and Trails legacy dollars, and not just those legacy dollars, but the desired outcomes and the desired future condition, thank you, that we all are working towards. So the effort, as was laid out in legislation, was to develop a 25-year long-range plan and a 10-year strategic coordination plan. This was an effort that was directed towards the Commissioner of DNR to present this plan to the legislature, which we did a few days ago, and I will review that in a second. It was also to outline a vision for the future, for not only the legacy dollars, but all traditional sources of funding that we use in the state. It was also to create a specific set of deliverables so that we had some targets and some benchmarks that we could establish for our activities. Let me go back to that one second. I want to draw your attention on the right-hand side there to the graphic that shows the focus, this legacy plan focus. And for those of you who can't see these intersecting rings, the top ring is Parks and Trails of Local Significance. The bottom ring is Parks and Trails of National Significance. The plan really focused on the two middle circles, which is Parks and Trails of Regional Significance and then Parks and Trails of State Significance. That is the sweet spot for this effort. What we're not talking about here are local parks that have a particular local constituency, and we're not talking about national parks or related national recreation interests. We're really talking about state and regional parks, as was directed by the legislative activities. The public participation process that was put together was very successful. We're very proud of the work that we did. Let me give you just a few numbers and some highlights of that. First of all, the Commissioner of Natural Resources appointed a steering committee, and at the end of my presentation, I will mention who those steering committee members were, a number of them here in the room. This is statewide. This is not just DNR. This is statewide representation. Our first action was to put together a summit of community leaders around the state to really begin to identify the major issues, the major barriers, and the opportunities that were within this legacy plan. We had that in April. We had a couple hundred individuals come together for a day of planning. That then led to a series of regional workshops throughout the state that went a number of weeks. We conducted 21 workshops around the state. We had 1,250 or so participants in those. We had very good participation in all areas. I think our smallest meeting was 20 people. Our largest meeting was over 80. And we, as you will see here in a few moments, I think we began the task at these meetings of starting to identify desired future conditions, who were the critical groups that we needed to be listening to, as well as somewhere what were the outcomes that we were going to be driving toward. Knowing that, in our world, when you have public meetings, you tend to get people who look a little bit like me, more than 20-year-olds. We also had a series of outreach activities for youth, and we hired a young man from the Conservation Corps of Minnesota who put on a number of workshops that included over 1,000 youth from junior high through college age. So we were able to ascertain from that group another set of data about how they foresaw outdoor recreation, what they wanted to see in their future, what they felt about resources, what they felt about skills and outdoor participation, and very, very successful. So we also spent time then with some targeted groups, some minority populations, some individual organizations that had something to offer us that we felt weren't going to be coming forward in the usual kind of public participation processes. And we also had a contract with the Citizen League, which is a nonprofit group that conducts public participation activities. And they were successful in asking a series of questions to online participants and distributing information. There were contacts with about 1,500 people through the Citizen League activity and their website. So in the aggregate, we had about 3,500 Minnesota residents of some type who attended a meeting, who were interviewed by one of our staff, who participated in some online activity. And in our fairly limited time period, we felt very good about that. Additionally, as we began to bring together this information, the steering committee started to break down issues into the key components of that became our plan. We asked the assistance of about 60 individuals who volunteered to work on various work groups, whether it was funding or resource protection or rehabilitation of existing facilities, whatever was that subject. We were able to bring those individuals in. Some of them came from a professional background, some of them came from special interest or some passion that they had about a particular area. But that added a lot of depth to our work. We also had, as driven by the legislature, the University of Minnesota produced a framework and an outline for our current outdoor recreation system that is partially a mapping exercise, breaking down into sub-regional areas what exists for regional parks and trails, state parks and trails, what are some common areas of opportunity, and what are some barriers to those. And there was also some social science work that the University of Minnesota brought together that and provided that work to the work groups and to the steering committee. So we had some social science data, we had some mapping, we had some other sources that were available to us to add depth and meaning to our evaluation. The important part of our work then, really listening to the citizens of Minnesota, and they had a number of very important things to say, and I'm just going to highlight these briefly. The drawings that you see there are one of the activities that we did with some of the younger youth groups, which was to have them do some drawings about what they would like to see for parks and trails in their future. Minnesotans are truly passionate about nature, and they, in our activities, they were willing to set aside their own personal interests and to collaborate with others to try and create that desired future condition. The participants would like to see something lasting and permanent come from the legacy dollars. It's a statement that came through many ways. Further, in terms of vision, most meetings had comments about creating another generation of stewards for our outdoor recreation estate. There were these phrases came about in different ways, but there was clearly a lot of interest in creating a next generation of stewards for the state of Minnesota. There are also many, many statements about children and youth and increasing participation, youth health, youth understanding of natural resources and phenomenon, connecting with youth in ways that would be engaging to them, many, many statements along those lines. There were also many comments about a balanced approach to the use of legacy dollars. There were very few statements about we want all or nothing, or we want to see all of the dollars going into one area or another. Pretty much everyone had a sense that there are a number of problems to be resolved, there are a number of opportunities to be taken advantage of, and a basic appreciation of the fact that there should be a balanced approach to that. We actually had a game that we used in the meetings where each table was given a certain number of play dollars, and they had to put these dollars into different categories. And I don't recall in one case, at one meeting, where all of the money went into one of the categories. That was just an indicator of this balanced approach. Very important statements about connections, connecting people to the out-of-doors, connecting trails to communities, connecting new users to new opportunities, many, many connection-type statements that were made. Participants were also interested in a full range of recreational opportunities. Those of us who maybe have had a niche or a set of experiences that we thought were appropriate in our particular world, we're being asked to think more broadly about that. That there are people from other places in the world who have moved here, people from other parts of the country, certain users of urban settings that are looking for something in the rural setting, and to expand our thoughts about what would be a wider range of recreational opportunities. And then finally, an appreciation of the fact that this is all about a statewide set of opportunities, but that there are regional differences. The things that are needed down in Jackson County are different than the things that are going to be needed up in Kitson County, which are different than the things that are going to be needed in Lake County. That while there is some values for statewide, there are regional differences that are very important. This picture, by the way, is the commissioner signing the transmittal of the 1025 legacy document to the legislature on February 14th. This was the event that we had in the rotunda, and you can see represented in the background some of the participants who came that day to commemorate and to celebrate a little bit this important date. There were four strategic connections that I'm going to take just a moment each one to go through. First is connecting people in the out-of-doors. The second is to acquire land and to develop opportunities. The third is take care of what we have. And the fourth is coordination among partners. So beginning with those pillars, that's really the most important walk away from this short presentation are these four pillars and the issues that cascade down from them. Connecting people to the out-of-doors, a goal, one of several in this, was increase the number of visits to parks of state and regional significance. We're going to have an increase of about 19% in our state population over the next 25 years. And there is a logical statement that we should be striving to at least have that level of increased participation in out-of-doors activities. Some of you may know that right now we are in the midst of a decline in outdoor recreational activities among most user groups and certainly among a lot of specific users. And so this is a big target for us. This is a big issue. And our steering committee, those who attended the public meetings, the work group members, recognize that this is a very, very important item. Some of the benchmarks, as I mentioned first about the raw visitation, which has many, many subtleties to it, youth and young adult interaction with programs and special events, creating older adult opportunities, people who are going to be able to volunteer, who are going to be able to take on some of the responsibilities of maintaining the recreation estate, the health-related issues to older generations. racial and ethnic minorities. There are some cultural barriers, there's some information barriers, there's some transportation barriers, and we've got a lot of information about that. Always a part of this is the quality of the experience. It's not just raw numbers, it's the values and the quality of the experience that people have in the out-of-doors. And then other issues like transportation and affordability. What can be done as a system to help lower those barriers that are out there? Here's some other mentions about that. This was a very creative environment for us to be looking forward. It is clearly a time of tension and transition where we've got some economic indicators that are challenging for all of us right now. On the other hand, we have some new opportunities, and so it's really the intersection of those two that creates that tension that we tried to work our way through. Acquire land and develop opportunities. You can see the stated goal there. This is one of the most common stated desires, is to acquire land. It is very unique to different regions and sub-regions of the state. And we try and highlight that in our document, that this is not a one-size-fits-all by any opportunity. For instance, in the Northwest, most of the statements about acquiring or land had to do with trails and connecting communities with trails. In other parts of the state, there may be a lack of opportunity at regional centers, and so there was more of an interest in creating parks and acquiring land so that down the road there could be some additional development and some new recreational opportunities. Some of the more specific priorities, new park and trail opportunities near regional centers. There was a wide range of discussions from Bemidji down to Rochester about regional centers and what might be lacking so that people didn't have to travel far, close to home kind of recreation. Some discussions of tourism in all of the areas of the state, but clearly this was a bullet that was really more focused on this close to home recreational opportunity. Additional miles of trails near population centers and near tourism areas. There are some many trail connections to this. The opportunities are out there for metro area, for regional centers, and for our state and regional trails to have many meaningful discussions over the next few years about how to achieve this connectivity that I talked about earlier and how to make the best use of the dollars that we have in order to solve some of those problems. Lots of unique situations around the state. Many of us in state parks and trails would be one of the organizations that would like to acquire in holdings within our state or our regional parks, and these would be focusing on high priority legacy type acquisitions. And then a number of comments or statements under develop opportunities have to do with the type of facilities we currently have. And I'll speak about my own system because I know the most about that. We have a system that was really created in the 20s and 30s and the 40s with regards to campgrounds. Our campgrounds are fairly traditional and have individual sites and some services that are related to that. There are people who come from other parts of the world and other parts of the country who want open spaces. They don't want that kind of individual gathering spot. They want to be able to get together in different ways. They want to have some different types of activities that we traditionally have not provided. So I think all of the systems are facing this, but it is an example of a opportunity that is out there for us to develop some new ways of servicing people. Also, there's some lifestyle and some markets that we can address, some individuals who may be single-parent moms or dads, some people who have some challenges to seeing themselves in an out-of-door setting, and we can create some opportunities for them to be able to experience that. This is also where some of the data from the University of Minnesota comes into play, where we can talk about a sub-regional level and where we're underserving people, where there are some needs that are demonstrated through some of the research that has been done. And this may occur through state parks, it might happen through grants, it might happen through the Met Council, but there's quite a bit of information out there about where we're long and where we're short on a number of these kind of services. Taking care of what we have. This may be the most understated, but in some ways the most important of all of these. Like a hospital, like a university, like a big farm, after many years, the best built of anything begins to wear out and develop some fatigue. In my system, this is certainly the case, and I know there's a number of parks and trail systems around the state who are now facing this at some level. And so some big statements about maintaining our infrastructure as well as improving the natural resources that we have in our system. There are a number of priorities with this related to the built environment, water, sewer, power, roads, the rehabilitation of visitor centers, the rehabilitation of restrooms, of trails. Again, speaking of DNR, parks and trails, we have 1,600 buildings. 600 of those have some kind of historic responsibility, that we have a responsibility to protect that historic nature. There are examples of that really all around the state, and that came out in many, many of our meetings. We're excited about new opportunities. We're excited about new trails, but there is a responsibility to take care of what we have. And I think at every meeting, at every conversation, there was an understanding that we need to take that responsibility very strongly. Roofs, windows, and trail surfaces, meeting standards for accessibility, retrofit for modern conveniences and future needs. I mentioned day use areas and camping facilities and visitor centers. In the specific area of natural resource restoration, most of the medium and larger systems have some decadent forests. We have prairies that we want to restore. We have riverine environments that need some help and support. We have tools to do a lot of these things, but there is a pretty steep ramp in some cases that we restore and replenish our natural resource base, and many positive comments around that. And finally, among the four strategic directions, Mr. Chairman, coordinate among partners. We have titled this various things, and it may seem like kind of an odd one that we state that boldly, but from the public's point of view, things appear to be pretty complicated and not always the most efficient, and the different layers of government working together, the special interest groups, some convening, and not always smoothest processes. So there were a number of statements about that. One of them, somewhat related, was about information. Getting information, finding information, downloading information, whether it's from a tourism point of view, whether it's from a recreation point of view, whether it's from a community planning point of view. Lots of statements about make the information process better for park and trail users, for new residents, and for non-users, lowering that barrier so that they can get outside. The creation of better databases of inventory, website improvements for apps and trip planning and all kinds of things. This also is where we're recommending the creation of an advisory council, advisory committee, around this legacy funding source. We are not recommending that this be a group that has funding authority, and not recommending that there be legislation around this. Our current feeling is that this should be an appointment made by the Commissioner of DNR. That being said, we have a number of recommendations on how we could balance statewide needs, have various interest groups represented, and have a dialogue around what should be the responsibilities and the opportunities for that advisory council. There's also quite a bit of statements about the coordination among the four legacy funds, that as we spoke around the state, there was a lot of confusion about the cultural dollars, the Lessard-Sams dollars, the clean water dollars. How does all that come together, and where are the opportunity costs and opportunity base for individuals or groups or organizations that want to get involved in that? So I think this is a rather clear challenge to those of us that are involved in this profession, but it has an umbrella over lots of other components that exist for all of us to work our way through over the next many years. This is a list of the steering committee for those of you who are interested, and those of you who can't read, I'm going to quickly read through them. Rick Anderson from Lyon County, who's a retired parks director and is now a county commissioner with Lyon County. Ron Bastian from the city of Rochester, Kathy Bergen from the city of Duluth, Chris Gears, Three Rivers Park District, Nancy Hansen, Minnesota Recreational Trail Users Association, Mark Cavanaugh, Hospitality Minnesota from Brainerd Baxter, Bob Banzeline from the Sabi Trail, Susan Schmidt from the Trust for Public Land, Arnie Steffrud, who is going to be speaking soon from the Metropolitan Council, Mark Thiemig, who is from Scott County, he's their Parks and Recreation Department, Steve Thorne, Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota, Colleen Tollefson, Explore Minnesota Tourism, and Chuck Woken from Stearns County Park and the Central Region Parks and Trails Coordinating Board. Those are the individuals who are on the steering committee, and if I could entertain, Mr. Chairman, just a brief comment by Rick and by Mark in terms of their role on the steering committee, and then we can move on to the next activity.
Thank you. Welcome. Identify each of yourselves, please.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Rick Anderson. I was former park director for Lyon County for 31 years and now a county commissioner. I'd first like to start out by saying it was an honor and a privilege to serve on this committee. Having never been involved in one, to see the process was truly an amazing thing. I think what Cortland has said during his talk resonates with all of us that sat on the committee, that we truly wanted this to be a plan for the state of Minnesota. Don Shelby at our summit challenged us to come with the idea that this is for we and not for me, and I think all the steering committee members pretty well left their hat at the door and looked at everybody's situation and took this to heart. I think the plan that we've put together here for the state is a good working document. I think it's going to be need to look at through time because it's hard to predict what will happen tomorrow. So, but it's a good start for the state of Minnesota, and I think that that'll be a good thing for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Thiemig, actually a resident of Shorewood. I'm near Excess here. I'd like to share a couple of insights that I took away from. I attended about 16 of the 21 regional meetings, and it was really, really wonderful to travel Minnesota and hear differences from the folks I talked to in Baudette and Thief River Falls compared to the folks who live in Savage, and just their differences in terms of long-term needs for parks and trails and what they want as residents of those areas. Two of the things that I really took away, one was that this creating the next generations of stewards is critical. We're losing kids to electronic media, and we're losing kids to things that are maybe less outdoor-oriented, and it's going to be more and more difficult to get those kids back. And so creating that next generation of stewards was really important throughout the state. People talked a lot about that. The second was, one of the ways you could do that is better marketing and awareness. As a profession, we don't typically market and promote what we do like a place like Valley Fair would do. And maybe we need to rethink that as we move forward and do things different and take a different approach to that marketing awareness thing. The third thing I thought was really important was it's not all about big things. Vermilion State Park was one of the things that people talked a lot about and how wonderful that will be in the future. But they also talked about little things like maybe there's incentives for senior citizens because senior citizens have time, they can get their grandkids out in the parks and they can reconnect those kids to nature. Transportation, using some of the legacy money to help foster transportation and creating those connections, and then doing things like rentals. If a family doesn't have camping equipment, making opportunities for that to happen. So a combination of big and little things, but it was really, really cool to be out and talk to folks from all over Minnesota and to get their perspective. And like Rick said, we really left our agency hats back at the door, and we tried to essentially interface as fellow citizens with those folks. So it was a great experience, and I thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions from anyone?
Okay.
Mr. Nelson, one question of you before Mr. Bowe gets going. One of your four pillars that you had to do with maintaining and operating our current system. To do it adequately, how much would you need each year?
Mr. Chairman, members, we were asked to do an assessment of that for our own division, and the short answer, Mr. Chairman, is that there is not enough legacy dollars to take care of all of the current DNR Parks and Trails needs, and that would be true for most of the systems around the state. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing that happened to us, that we have these dollars that are coming our way now. It couldn't have come at a better time, but these dollars will not be able to meet all of the needs that exist for all of our systems around the state.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nelson. And I actually didn't mean to suggest that we could have enough legacy funding to do that. But what monies would it take? I mean, how much total dollars, wherever they come from?
For the operation and maintenance needs for DNR Parks and Trails, which would be an example I would purport to you of the various systems, we would come about $6 million short annually of what it would take just to operate our system that we have. The capital needs for Parks and Trails in the aggregate, there is a backlog of a couple hundred million dollars of rehabilitation, renovation, and restoration that exists currently in our system. Forrest, do you remember another measurement that we had of that particular question?
Yes, I do. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Forrest Bowe, I'm the Deputy Director for the Parks and Trails Division. I remember one of the key points in our budget exercise was it had to do with trails. And if you think about the state trail system that we have 26 state trails that have been identified in statute, around 2,500 miles total. We have 1,250 of those miles built, so about 50%. The example I'd use is it would take all of the legacy dollars for the next 25 years to only purchase and develop the state trail system. It doesn't leave any money for state parks or resource management work or the Met Council Park system or the Greater Minnesota Park system. So to kind of frame things up, just take one piece. We have far greater needs in all of the systems than what our legacy dollars will allow us to do. And it will need a good mixture of all kinds of funding, whether it be legacy or bonding dollars, future LCCMR dollars, to really make a dent in the providing a system.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wagenius?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, our nonpartisan fiscal staffer, Jim Reinholtz, did a one-page, both sides sheet on the shortfalls in parks on one side, trails on the other side. I think it would be very helpful. He looked at all sources of funding and how they would come in, including bonding, because we have had bonding as a traditional source. But that would be a helpful sheet, Mr. Chair, I think, for you and for members, and maybe even helpful for Mr. Reinholtz to give a quick description of how he got there.
Thank you. That's good to be reminded. And now, Representative Winkler, I was going to give you a better introduction, but
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the thought anyway. I don't know if this is the right time to ask the question, but we had a discussion yesterday, Mr. Nelson or Mr. Bowe, about where the money is spent in the parks funds, and specifically metro versus out Greater Minnesota kind of breakdown, and I don't know if you have numbers, but as I look at the three funds, the Metro Regional Parks, the DNR Regional Park and Trail Grants, and then the DNR State Parks and Trails, if you have kind of a breakdown in dollars about where they go in Seven County, Metro versus Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I have all of that information. I think we'll cover the majority of what you asked in my next seven slides in the presentation, and if I didn't hit exactly your point, please ask the question again.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think it's good to proceed then.
All right. So again, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. A few comments before I really start into the presentation, and I think to kind of preface everything, you've heard a lot about the plan, and so now we have a plan, and what we're recommending from here on out is how do we implement that plan, and that of course begins with a plan and a budget to start to implement that. So what I'm hoping you'll see here today is a strong relationship between that Parks and Trail legacy plan and the budget proposal that is before you, and to point out that the governor's budget proposal does implement the key elements that are in the plan, and Cortland had mentioned what those four key elements are. I wanted also to remind you that in the constitutional language for the Parks and Trail Fund, it uses the word support. So I believe it was recognized that there is a need to maintain and protect our strong legacy of parks and trails that we have in Minnesota. We need to connect our citizens to the outdoors and to these opportunities. We need to take care of the system that we have, no matter if it's a state park system, a metro area system, or a regional system. And we need to identify and take on some new things, take some new opportunities that are in front of us, and probably build on increased partnerships. I don't know that the public really cares whether it's a state park system or a metro county park system or a metropolitan system or a regional park system. Or a state recreational area. They just want to recreate. And all of our systems offer something a little bit different, but it's clear that everyone enjoys these kinds of systems. So we've inherited this system from our forefathers, and I think the citizens have recognized that we need to continue that. And so we're going to proceed to implement the plan and make a lasting legacy for the future citizens. The funding mechanism that we have is really provided by the three major providers. And to Representative Winkler's question, what hopefully you'll hear about is the DNR Parks and Trails system. We have another presentation following mine with Arnie Steffrud from the Metro Council. And then with regard to the grant program, which are for Minnesota Parks and Trails of regional and statewide significance. So I think with that, I'll dive in. What I wanted to do first was to take a quick look back, and in your packet, I believe you've got our Minnesota State Parks and Trails 18-month legacy report. So I just wanted to, again, take a quick look back at what we've been able to accomplish with the funds that were allocated during the last session. If you remember, or you may remember, that the funding was really was given to DNR to accomplish items in three areas. Number one was to connect people to the outdoors. Number two was to accelerate our natural resource management efforts. The third area was to accelerate our maintenance and rehabilitation of facilities. And then the fourth area was to provide grants. So let me just talk about some of the outcomes in each of those areas. And I won't go into this. It's a pretty detailed document. I think we're pretty proud of all of the accomplishments we've been able to do in the past 18 months. But let me just hit a few highlights. We have put in place new outdoors programs called the ICANN series. We have Icon Camp. We've had a lot of new people come in. We partnered with REI. They provided the equipment, the tents. We've focused on some of our target markets and got people that had never been to a state park or never been camping before and provided them the opportunity. Through a variety of programs, including the Icon Camp, outdoor extra programs like rock climbing, live animals, all of those kinds of things, we figure we reached nearly 10,000 new participants in parks. So that I think that's a pretty good accomplishment for some of these new ways of connecting with people. We also were able to fill 30 Minnesota Naturalist Corps positions, and these are the people in parks. They're naturalists, so that when people come to a state park, we have a naturalist there that can provide them with a program. There was some 266,000 people that were involved in our programs, 21% over the previous year. We had a lot more overnight visits than we have in the past. We had 100,000 people increase in the last 2 years in overnight visits. We were able to provide some new touch screen kiosks, both at impressive places like the Mall of America and really allowing people to do their trip planning and get information where a lot of people are. And also having some new touchscreen devices right in the parks. We made a lot of website improvements. We have virtual tours now, so you can kind of see what you're getting into. For many people, they've never been to a state park, and so to have a virtual tour that you can see the campsite or the camper cabin or the lodge that you might stay in seems to provide a very interesting way of getting oriented to the park. In the area of accelerating resource management, we were able to restore nearly 3,000 acres of native plant communities. We conducted invasive species and detection and response and prevention to those on nearly 20,000 acres. We did a lot of prescribed burning, really accelerating the natural resource management that we're able to do in state parks and on state trails. We also accelerated our facility maintenance and rehabilitation. We did several renewal projects on state trails. We repaved 15 miles of part of the Heartland Trail, the Paul Bunyan Trail, the Munger State Trail. Redid many bridges. And if those that were here during the last biennium, you know that's probably one of my kind of near and dear subjects. We have 350 bridges in our state trail system. These are mainly railroad-grade bridges, and they've served us well for literally centuries, but they're getting old. We've got 100 of them that are over 100 years old, and the more inspections we do, the more we're finding that there are some severe deficiencies in bridges. We've had to close 9 over the last 2 years. We currently have 2 that are under limited restrictions, but we were able to use legacy dollars to either rehabilitate or replace several bridges in our state trail system. You also know that we did several plans over the last 2 years, planning for our 10-year strategic plan in our division. We did the 1025 legacy plan, and we also provided the Parks and Trails budget analysis that Cortland referred to some time ago. With all of these, we used the Conservation Corps of Minnesota to accomplish much of the work, and you'll see in the presentation as I get into the proposal that we would continue to want and need to use the services of the Conservation Corps. And with regard to grants, we were able to provide 50 grants to local communities, providing $8.5 million to forward parks and trails of regional or statewide significance throughout the state. So that's a quick look back. And now we'll move on to what the governor's recommendation is. And the governor's recommendation supports the 4 pillars of the legacy plan. And those pillars are to connect people to the outdoors, acquire land, develop opportunities, take care of what we have, and basically work better together. In the area of connect people to the outdoors, I'll be working off some of the fact sheets that you might have in front of you now, and I think you also have the presentation in front of you. We have several key goals and measures, and just to provide a few example measures, again, working to create gateways to the outdoors through outreach opportunities for our state parks, our campgrounds, our forest areas, providing more of those experiences that build on skill building or the I Can series, where people didn't know how to do something before. We want to help them so they can get outside and do that. And also enhance our marketing and outreach so that we're creating a greater awareness and people know what to expect. Basically, we think these virtual tours have been very helpful, and we're going to continue to do those and also increase those conservation education and interpretation programs. The second pillar is to acquire land and develop opportunities. A few of the key goals and measures under this pillar are: we need to improve the ADA accessibility in our state parks and trails. As Cortland said, our state park system was really developed during the 1930s and 40s for the most part, and the ADA requirements and even building codes and a lot of those things were very different then than they are now. And we need to upgrade our facilities in order to have meet the needs of our new populations. And we're all getting older. We need to increase energy conservation.
Mr. Ball, excuse me. Do we have copies of what you're going over now? Do you know?
This is in the fact sheets, and I'm hitting on some of the key measures that are on the fact sheets. That's the report. You should have a copy of the fact sheet. It's called Investing. Yeah. That's it. Investing in our state parks
these
and
two.
Trails.
The two sheets, right?
Correct.
All right.
I'm going over the investing in our state parks and trails now. The next one will be in the grants program.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Yes. Again, in that area, that second area of acquire land and develop opportunities, we will acquire strategic high priority parcels. We need to develop and redevelop our park and trail facilities to provide a wide variety of recreational needs and opportunities, and also continue to do more of that trail repair, replacing bridges, providing interpretation of our cultural and natural resources along the trails, and the repaving of some of those trails. In the area of taking care of what we have, this is probably the largest area of the pillars. We're going to continue to restore native landscapes. We've set out on a pace to do 600 to 700 acres per year of prairie restorations. Over the next 25 years, we will have accomplished all the acres that are currently in state parks and will have restored all those acres that need to be restored. We will continue to do an increased number of prescribed burns. We'll continue to map and control those invasive species. We will enhance our facility repairs. We have over 5,000 campsites, 68 group sites, 1,250 miles of trail, nearly 6,500 picnic sites, 36 swimming beaches. There is just a lot of infrastructure and items out there that need to have continual repair and enhancement. And again, repairing bridges and trails. And through all of this, again, we will continue to use the Conservation Corps of Minnesota to accomplish much of that work. Finally, we will coordinate among the partners. And this, again, as Cortland mentioned in the plan, was one of the things the plan had mentioned. And we have talked about creating an advisory group to both promote and coordinate the implementation of the plan, and again increase coordination between all the agencies that provide these facilities. With regard to the Parks and Trails Fund grant program, so this would be the second fact sheet that you have. Excuse me. The governor recommends $6.165 million each year of the biennium. This grant program is administered by the DNR. We are not eligible for the program, and the grants go to parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. Clearly, there's a demand for parks and trails. There's greater demand than what we have available funds for, and that could be said in all of the areas, whether it's the grants portion, the metropolitan portion, or the DNR's portion. We have, in today's challenging economy, local units of government are constantly looking for grant programs. Clearly, they do not have the funding to provide the needs out there. There is a 25% match required for the grants program. The grant program is found in Minnesota Statute 85.535. And just quickly, I think, to answer Representative Winkler's question, of those 50 grants that were given out over the last biennium, totaling $8.5 million, 80% of those grants were in the outstate areas, and 20% of the grant money went to the metro area. One thing I would point out, the program, the legacy program itself has grown, and that's because we're collecting two full year of taxes this time. If you recall, we were only about a year and a half or so during the last biennium. So the fund has grown. There were several items that were also kind of what I would call taken off the top last time. So if we think about the 1025 legacy plan, the money that went to the University of Minnesota for developing the mapping, the framework, and those kinds of things, in the governor's budget, those off-the-top items were put into the grant side of the program. So the grant side of the program gets a 28% increase under the governor's proposal. DNR and Met Council's increase is 15%, and it's only because of the growth in the fund. I'll end with just a brief picture of our overall budget for 10 and 11. And as you can see, the Park and Trail Fund contributed nearly 19% of DNR Parks and Trails budget. But also remember that the grants portion is in here too. So much of the money that comes to DNR Park and Trail Division is really put out in grants, and that could be through the Grant and Aid Snowmobile Program, Grant and Aid Ski Program, and certainly through the Parks and Trails Fund. There was, again, about $8.5 million out of this that had gone to grants.
Thank you, Mr. Bowe. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowe, I was going to ask you about, I appreciate the information on this on the state grants program, but what about the state parks? Do you have, I think there are two or maybe three state parks in the metro area, and can you delineate that by dollar amounts?
Mr. Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we have three state parks in the metro area. They are Fort Snelling, Afton, and William O'Brien. As far as operating budget or legacy dollars?
Legacy dollars. Mr. Chair, legacy dollars.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Ball. Chair, Representative Winkler, I don't have it with me broke down into what kind of legacy dollars went into those three state parks, but I could certainly try to pull that apart for you. We clearly did a lot of our outreach efforts in the metropolitan area and utilized those parks to a great deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowe, the only
Representative Winkler.
Reason is just to have an understanding as we have a discussion about equity. We have these areas, but it's helpful to know where the dollars actually went. And we can figure out what that means, but I'd like to actually just know what the numbers are.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Equity is in the mind of the beholder.
Mr. Chair, but dollar amounts are not.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bowe, and Mr. Nelson. From the beginning, of the public meetings that I attended, I was a little confused about what you were doing, and I'm less confused now. But how are you keeping the money separate, except that the legacy money goes through this committee and the parks and trails operating money goes through Representative McNamara's committee? And I haven't studied that at all, but how does the public know that we're not substituting with the legacy gifts?
Mr. Nelson.
Chairman, Adam, as you know, the law in 2010 required that we track legacy dollars. And so we are working on that system. We can track down to the park and the area management level of any legacy dollars that went out into the field. And we also have an accounting of the dollars from the legacy fund that went into the various subsets that Forrest covered in his report. We worked very hard not to get in the way of that particular problem, the supplement supplant. And frankly, it was a great opportunity for us, this first biennium, to add to, in most cases, the opportunities that were already in place. We had naturalists. We added more seasonal naturalists. We were doing resource work. We added more resource work. So I think we are fine when it comes to that. It is clearly something we have concerns about as we move forward, particularly with the general fund reduction. And I think the answers to that question and related questions are yet to be concluded. We can give you some examples, I think, at every level of the organizations we're involved in that. The difficulty that, or the lack of difficulty that we had the first biennium, I think is going to be more difficult in the second biennium because of the general fund reduction, particularly for DNR Parks and Trails and the Met Council.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, and could you talk more about the third pillar and the separation of the funds under the third pillar? To keep what we have or maintain what we take care of what we have.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, in fact, in that case, that may be a little easier than in the other areas. We, in our case, in DNR Parks and Trails, we seek bonding dollars, we seek LCCMR dollars, we get federal grants. We have user fees that go into the system, and we have tried and will continue to use legacy dollars to augment those opportunities. We created a definition for ourselves that I think worked quite well, that particularly in the rehabilitation component, that we would use these dollars to do things that otherwise we weren't going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. As an example, we have visitor centers that were built over the last several years. And when those we can't use bonding dollars for the rehabilitation of the interpretive activities in those visitor centers. They don't qualify. So most of our visitor center displays are very old and are in need of rehabilitation. We're using legacy dollars to do that. That augments other dollars that may go into that. Up in your area, Jay Cook, our new building at Jay Cook, we use legacy dollars to rehabilitate the interpretive displays in the older building and use bonding dollars to fix many other problems in that building where the bonding definition applied. So that's an example that I feel pretty good about, how we applied the concept of supplement supplant to funding opportunities where we're adding dollars to an existing funding stream from some source. Does that help?
It does a lot. And I appreciated what you said, too, as you were going through and saying that the people at the meetings and the public didn't really care which pot it's coming from, just that they have new experiences and they have safe places to visit and to carry out their activities that they want to do. But I just was worried from the two meetings I went to. I didn't see that at that time, but it's much clearer now. But I think the pillars help a lot.
Thank you. And, you know, if you're ever really concerned about whether or not your money is supplanting or supplementing and feel you can't spend any more because it might be supplanting, Representative Davids, Representative Cornish, and I all have areas in our districts that would certainly only be supplementing.
Mr. Chairman, duly noted.
Is that right? Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Arnie Stefford. I'm a planning analyst in the Parks Program at the Metro Council. And I am also accompanied by Bo Carlson, who's the Associate Superintendent at Three Rivers Park District, and Steve Sullivan from Dakota County Parks. My purpose today is to give you an overview of the budget for the Metro Regional Park System under legacy dollars. You have this slideshow in your packet. Plus, I added a couple of more slides, and they're from this little handout. The presentation will cover essentially 3 points, an overview of the park systems to give you a sense of what that is, linking again to the past appropriation for fiscal year 10 and 11, and then talking about the 12-13 budget. The Metro Park System is owned and operated by 10 county, city, and special park district agencies. None of it is owned by the Metro Council. It includes Anoka County, Ramsey County, Washington County, Dakota County, Scott County, Carver County, plus the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, the City of St. Paul, the City of Bloomington is also a park agency involved with this, and Three Rivers Park District in suburban Hennepin County. There are 54,600 acres currently in use for the public, and they host 38 million visits a year, not visitors, but visits. So there, one individual, for instance, could repeatedly visit a park over a period of time, and that's counted as one visit each time. There are 39 regional parks ranging in size from 100 to 500 acres, and one example of this is Lake Waconia Park in Carver County. There are 12 park reserves ranging in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres. And 80% of those lands are essentially set aside for wildlife, habitat, and natural resource and environmental education purposes. And one example is Rice Creek Chain of Lakes Park Reserve up in Anoka County. There are 7 special recreation features, which are unique, one-of-a-kind facilities that provide experiences not typically found elsewhere in the regional park system. And one example is the Nuremberg Floral Garden on the shore of Lake Minnetonka. That's managed by Three Rivers Park District. A couple of other examples are the Como Conservatory and the Como Zoo, which are managed by the City of St. Paul. There are 38 trails currently in operation, if you will, encompassing 231 miles. We have 1,000 miles total planned for the system. And an example of that is the Big Rivers Regional Trail in Dakota County. Now, the question was raised earlier in regards to what's your visitation? Why are these parks regional? Well, in 2008, we hired a consultant to do person-to-person interviews of park visitors and trail visitors, and this is the result. 55% of the people visiting those parks and trails were what we call local visitors. An Anoka County resident visiting a regional park in Anoka County is a local visitor. 45% of those visitors came from outside that park agency's jurisdiction. So someone from Isanti County or Sherburne County or Douglas County that was also visiting that Anoka County Regional Park is a non-local visitor. This 45% figure, out of that, 4% are from folks from Greater Minnesota, and 4% are from people from outside the state. The legacy appropriation in 2011 and 10 and 11, excuse me, was split under this pie chart as you see here. And the 12-13 budget essentially is patterned after that. As Forrest Bowe pointed out, there's essentially equal shares for metro regional parks in the state park system, and then there was a chunk for the statewide grants program, $8.87 million, and $650,000 for the trail plan, for the legacy plan, excuse me, and the parks and trails inventory. In 12-13, that statewide stuff for the plan and the inventory disappears. There is growth in the statewide grants program, as Forrest pointed out. There's a slight difference between the metro parks and the state park system, and that's because in 2010 there was a requirement by statute that $38,000 be spent of legacy money to do sampling of natural resource restoration projects statewide. So that's in the DNR pot, if you will, in the light blue, and some of that will occur in metro regional parks. So that's why there's a slight difference between the two. We also use the pillars in the plan in regards to how funds are being spent for the legacy dollars. So I won't go over those again with you. But this is a graphic of how those dollars were spent using those pillars as the categories. Roughly 2% was for connecting people to the outdoors, and that essentially was programming to attract new visitors, environmental education coordinator, etc., that weren't being offered before. 10% is required in law to be spent on land acquisition. 41% was for creating opportunities, essentially developing new facilities in existing parks or entirely new parks, is the premise behind that. And 43% was done or spent for taking care of what we have, with 3% used for working together, working better together. And that essentially was for master plans to update what should be done in existing parks in the future and new parks. And all of the details of this pie chart are in this 86-page report in the Legislative Reference Library, which was delivered yesterday. And there's an electronic version of it as well. I'm trying to work with the LCC to get it posted on the legacy website as well. But this has the detail for every one of those projects funded with the dollars that you see here. So for fiscal year 12 and 13, there's a shift a bit in regards to how the dollars are being spent. But again, it's within the context of those pillars that you've just reviewed. 3% is going to be used for connecting people to the outdoors. There's an increase to 19% for acquisition of land. And the reason why is 10% will be used for park acquisition grants yet to be awarded. And also 9% is to help pay off essentially timed payments for buying land that was acquired in 2010, with the first installment financed with a legacy grant, and two more installments in 12 and 13 will be financed also with legacy dollars. 54% will be used to take care of what we have, and 23% will be used for essentially for new park and trail facilities, and finally 1% for master planning. And the details of these projects are in your handout at the end of the packet. There's a spreadsheet there that illustrates each project, which agency will be doing the work, what the work is, how it's connected to this pie chart, as well as when the fiscal 12 or fiscal 13 appropriation, when it would be done. So in regards to the distribution of the money amongst these 10 agencies, this graphic is a summation of the statute that is the formula that is used to distribute this money. 10% off the top is for park acquisition grants. That's matched with Metro Council bonds and funds provided by the park agency that's buying the property. So for every dollar of legacy money, there's $1.20 of regional bonds and local funding that's matching that. In regards to the remaining 90% of the appropriation, this is the formula that's used to distribute the money amongst the park agencies. We look at the population of each park agency, 35% is based on that, We look at how many visits each agency hosts. 20% of the money is based on that factor. 20% is based on how much they each spend to operate and maintain their portion of the system. 15% is based upon how many non-local visits they host. And then finally, 10% is based on how much land they manage. So this is the end result of what that 90% of the 12-13 budget, how it would be allocated amongst the 10 park agencies using the formula that I've just described. So that's my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steffarud, I've just got a couple questions. So the coming biennium, the governor's recommendation is to increase by about 13% of the pie, take care of what we have, is the way you classified that. Would that, is that, am I looking at that right, or am I missing something?
Mr. Steffarud.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is the agencies that have decided once we, you know, cut the pie into 10 pieces, this is the result of what their elected boards have decided to do with their share. And this is a cumulative illustration of that. So in answer to your question, yes, there is an increase from the previous biennium in taking care of what we have. And it's essentially renovation of existing facilities. It's mostly capital type of expenditures that have a long-lasting effect. And in regards to creating or building new facilities, they're spending less relative to what was, you know, proposed and or funded and spent in fiscal year 10 and 11, if you compare the two pie charts. Here's 10 and 11. Here's 12, 13.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Steffarud, how is the governor taking care of what we have in your base budget compared to the last biennium, either percentage-wise or dollars?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the general fund appropriation that supplements local funding to operate and maintain the park system, the governor's recommending a 40% reduction in the general fund base, which is about $1.4 million a year. However, there's also natural resource fund dollars from the lottery in lieu of sales tax, which are not being reduced. So the net effect of the governor's budget for operations and maintenance is a reduction of 16%.
Representative McNair.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steffarud, if I can follow then, the governor reduced you by 40% on one hand. You said he backfilled it, I believe you were saying, with a little bit, but it's still a 16% reduction there. But then this plan is to increase, take care of what we have by 13%.
Mr. Steffarud. Yeah,
Mr. Chair and Representative, in that regard, these general fund and lottery in lieu of sales tax, the natural resources fund monies, are used for essentially for day-to-day type operations and maintenance expenditures that would not have what we would call a long-lasting impact. What you see here in this pie chart is essentially replacing existing facilities that have worn out, replacing a trail, replacing a parking lot, replacing a building, and consequently, it's a capital expenditure, primarily what you see here, versus a non-capital expenditure on the operations and maintenance budget that I just described to you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steffarud, did we ever used to do any of that under the general fund budget before?
Mr. Chair and Representative, in regards to doing capital projects with general fund dollars?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Steffarud, you alluded to a number of things that are done currently with legacy money, and the governor has proposed cutting your budget by 40%. I'm wondering, any of the things that you talked about, were they ever done before with the pot of money that the governor cut 40%?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what's proposed for the legacy dollars is essentially separate and distinct from the general fund appropriation. And the types of activities are different. As I said, the legacy money is used for what we would call capital expenditures. Bonding, it, you know, has a long-term impact. There have been bond dollars and bond funds that have been used in addition to these legacy dollars to renovate and replace worn-out facilities. Again, a trail that lasts 20 years, a building that lasts 50 years. In regards to the general fund money, that's to paint the building. And it's to clean the glass and the windows. I should also point out that that budget is a small slice of what these agencies spend to operate and maintain their system, the system as a whole. $86 million was spent in 2009 to operate and maintain the Metro Regional Park system. About $8 million was provided by the state for that purpose.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and restate it again. Mr. Stefarud, have any of the things that you talked about in here been funded under the general fund budget in the past? I understand you told me many of them are not. That wasn't my question.
Okay, Mr. Chair and
Mr. Stefarud,
since I don't operate and maintain the park system, these monies flow through the council. I couldn't specifically state if legacy dollars are replacing or would be replacing general fund dollars. I could refer that to my colleagues on either side of me.
Mr. Chair, whenever it's appropriate, I would just like to, if somebody does know the answer, if they don't, if they could get back to me, because I think it's interesting. On one hand, we're cutting at 40%, and then on the other hand, we're increasing it by 13%. I just find that interesting. It's nice to know the bar that's being set for us, because then I know where I'm coming from. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do any of you gentlemen know the answer to Representative McNamara's question? If not, get back to us.
I can only speak to Dakota County. In the case of Dakota County,
identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Sullivan with Dakota County. In the case of Dakota County, no O&M type dollars that would have been lost as part of the governor's budget would be used for taking care of what we have.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. Again, Mr. Sullivan, that wasn't my question. My question was, have you in the past used those dollars for anything that would be used under the take care of what we have? I understand what you're saying now, but I'm wondering if anything in the past, if those dollars that are getting cut 40%, and if they're not, that I'm cool with that. I'm just trying to find out the answer, because I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Sullivan.
The answer from Dakota County simply is no.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefarud, one more time, will you clarify for me what park agency is?
The 10 park agencies.
Stefarud.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 10 park agencies are the Anoka County Parks Department, the Washington County Parks Department, Carver County Parks Department, Dakota County, Scott County, etc., and in the graphic with that in the first slide. So those are the only ones, and they're defined in statute. And they may own and operate some local parks that are not part of this system. So we only give them grants for the regional parks that they operate and maintain.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefarud, could you step through again the land acquisition portion of this? You're taking, I understand, 10% off the top, but you're also using some dollars, legacy dollars, to make ongoing land acquisition payments. Could you just step through that again and maybe put a little more detail in there for us?
In the case of the fiscal year 12-13 budget, 10% is proposed to be used off the top for buying land yet to be acquired. The other 9% is for two payments in 12 and in 13 on a purchase of property along the Mississippi River in the city of Minneapolis. That's part of a regional park. It's part of the Minneapolis Park Board's allocation in this budget. And when they purchased the property in 2010, the seller said, I will be happy to get four installments on it. Give me money today, give me money a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. The first installment was financed with legacy dollars. and the second and third are proposed to be financed with legacy dollars.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stefford, so the the down payment was made with 2010 legacy dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, actually.
Mr. Stefford.
It would be fiscal year 2011 legacy dollars.
And there's another 10% of the 2012-13 dollars that will be used for other land acquisition projects?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And then finally, that 9% then of the upcoming or proposed allocation is to be used for making payments on that original acquisition.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Stefford.
Thank you.
Who do I have? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefford, I think you said that you have a total operating budget of about $80 million.
Representative, the agencies report to us how much they spend to operate and maintain the system, and we review that. We audit this so that there's consistency among the 10 agencies, and the 2009 expenditures was $86 million.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and then and you, I think, testified that roughly $8 million of that was from the general fund?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Stefford.
Roughly $8 million of that was from the General Fund and the Natural Resources Fund combined.
Okay.
Representative Winkler.
And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Stefford, and then, so it's 86 total, 8 from the General Fund and the Natural Resources Fund. And then the Legacy Fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there was no money from the Legacy Fund for operations and maintenance. It was through property taxes collected by each of the 10 agencies for their part of the system and user fees.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, that's about, what, 80-some percent of is coming from property taxes to fund the metro regional parks?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Stefford.
Representative, I don't have the breakdown on the property tax portion of this. Each agency would have to provide that because it varies from agency to agency. But that is a primary source of financing their part of the system. That's why they seek and receive some supplemental assistance from the state for operations and maintenance. The law talks about providing 40% of these costs financed with state dollars, but that's never happened since 1985 when the law was enacted.
Representative Winkler.
Then, Mr. Chair, just a final follow-up question, I guess. When you do your land acquisition, do you do that directly, or do the 10 agencies do that directly, or do they contract with private nonprofits to do it, or how does, you know, are landowners less sensitive to the Metropolitan Council and the Twin Cities than they are to the DNR in Greater Minnesota?
Mr. Stefford.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the acquisitions are negotiated between the park agency and the seller. Sometimes the park agency will work with a nonprofit organization like Trust for Public Land to be the broker, if you will. And there may be a donation. One example of that is in Scott County, where there was a partial donation of land, the value of the property, that was part of the transaction. We provided a grant to finance the remainder, the remaining cost, if you will. And Scott County put up 25% of non-state funding to the our match, to our grant, for that remainder. So that's how it's done.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to understand better. So the Trust for Public Land, maybe one of the agencies can talk about it. How do they get involved in this case? Because in this appropriation, I don't think there are direct appropriations to any of those nonprofits. So maybe I don't know if you can speak to land acquisition outside of your area, but how do you do it? And how would you involve the nonprofits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, for the record, my name is Bo Carlson. I'm the Associate Superintendent with Three Rivers Park District. For the most part, as Mr. Stefford mentioned, when we're dealing with land acquisitions, it is the agencies themselves that are doing those acquisitions directly. We receive our dollars from the Metropolitan Council. We negotiate with the property owner. Then we have that relationship and complete that purchase. if there is a situation where an agency might not have the cash or the dollars up front to facilitate that purchase, they would then contract with Trust for Public Land. It would still be the agency itself that would be the end recipient of the dollars through the Metropolitan Council, and then it would be their relationship to deal with Trust for Public Land for whatever their carrying costs may be or whatever fees would be associated for Trust for Public Land's relationship in that negotiation or purchase in the end. But for the most part, it's always the agency that is the recipient of the dollars and then would be the pass-through to the end recipient.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, I wonder, so does the nonprofit fill the gap, the funding gap, through their resources, or do they provide the relationships, or do they, I'm trying to understand what the roles are.
Chair Erdahl, Representative Winkler, again, this is a rare occurrence within the regional system. Oftentimes it is funding in the gap. When we have a period of time when there isn't the dollars available through our Acquisition Opportunity Fund, or an agency may not have the capital needed up front to make those purchases all at once. Again, typically, even within those contracted relationships or those contracted connections with Trust for Public Land and a park agency, the agency is very closely involved in the negotiation and the land purchase itself. It's more a matter of cash flow of acquiring at that particular time, having a carrier that can assist in that acquisition, and then paying it off over a longer term.
Are you done, Representative Winkler?
Not quite, Mr. Chair.
Keep going. Representative Winkler.
So just to summarize, I'm trying to make sure I kind of get the number. It's not so much that they're playing a broker kind of relationship. It's more like they're playing a bridge financing relationship.
Mr. Chair, heard all Representative Winkler. That would be a good way to describe it.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefford, I'm still wrestling with this land acquisition process. Are those, on this particular acquisition, are those even payments through those four payments that you mentioned earlier?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
Mr. Stefford.
The initial payment, the park board match, the grant from the Metro Council, and the premise behind that is that under this law, 10% off the top for acquisition must be matched. And these next two payments, there is a match in the sense that the park board will be dealing with a portion of that with its own funding, if you will. So in the end, 25% of the cost of acquiring this property will be financed with non-state funds, plus the Metro Council provided in that first grant a 40% match to the state's money. So there's a significant amount of non-state funding in total going towards buying these properties compared to these other grants that are for facility renovations or facility development.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefford, you gave me some good information there, but the structure of this loan is what I'm interested in. Is it evenly spaced out through time, or is there a balloon payment at the end, for instance?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Stefford.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's evenly spaced out through time.
Mrs. Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Stefford, who is obligated to make those payments if for some reason legacy dollars were not part of the picture? Who is obligated to make those ongoing payments?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Minneapolis Park Board would be. They're the acquirer of the property. They made the deal with the seller.
Representative Parkinson.
And just one more question about the acquisition itself. Was this acquired from a willing seller or eminent domain, or what was the process involved?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this was acquired from a willing seller. We've never used eminent domain other than when a seller and the buyer disagree on a price and they collectively say, let's take it to an eminent domain panel to determine the value.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a short presentation on behalf of the 10 implementing agencies that are within the audience.
Okay.
Thank you.
Short, please.
We'll keep it very short, Mr. Chair. On behalf of the 10 implementing agencies, we're here to express our support of the governor's recommendation of a 42%, 42%, 16% split between the DNR, the Metro Regional Parks, and the statewide grant program. The regional park system is 37 years old, and it was established to essentially be the state park system of the metro area, with only three of the state parks within the metro area. Those remaining parks in the greater Minnesota result in really a wonderful combination of natural resource based recreation that can serve both the metro and the greater Minnesota area. This has been working well. Also, our system is governed by the Metropolitan Council, and as a result, while we own the parks, we are subject to the standards and the policies of the regional system, and all 10 agencies have to comply with those standards. We have a long-term business plan. This was something that was asked of this committee yesterday. The Met Council, in combination with the implementing agencies, has developed a 2030 vision plan, and within that, we look at an additional 1,500 acres, 700 miles of new trail, two new parks to provide service to underserved areas, and recreational facility improvements that total $280 to $390 million. This isn't a Christmas list. This 2030 plan was scrutinized both publicly and politically by the Met Council. Also, beyond the 2030 plan, we do master plans for each park and trail. These master plans also get public and political review. These trails and parks are also included in the cities and townships' comprehensive plans. And lastly, we have a five-year short-term business plan, which is our capital improvement program, and where we place only those highest priority capital improvements within, I think, the list that you're seeing today and also our bonding requests. With that, we also, the 2030 plan is aligned with the 2011 Parks and Trails Legacy Plan. New parks, according to the Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, new parks and trail opportunities should occur where Minnesota's densely populated and growing areas of the state are. In the case of Dakota County, there was a hole in the system, and it was in our growth belt, which is in the Lakeville-Farmington area, and Representative McNamara and this legislature was very key in delivering a 456-acre regional park to serve the system. The Parks and Trails Legacy Plan also suggests that new trails be put where there is concentrations of population, and the City of St. Paul and Minneapolis are working hard on developing trail improvements along the Mississippi River. As Cortland mentioned, there's a need for us to take care of what we have. At 37 years old, we need to protect that capital infrastructure that's in place, as well as continue to be good stewards to the natural resources, some of the best lands within the metro area. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Bo. He has a few words as well.
He's got about half the time you had.
Again, Mr. Chair, thank you for the time. For the record, Bo Carlson of Three Rivers Park District. I'll try to make it quick. So why are we a good investment for Parks and Trails legacy dollars? We continue to protect the best lands in the metropolitan area. We provide the natural resource recreation that's close to where the people are, where the people live, and it's where they reside. With the increase in the gas prices, we're going to see more and more folks recreating closer to home, providing those opportunities closer to home, and connections closer to home, whether those are trail connections into our regional parks or park reserves, or utilizing our trails to enter into the workplace to use them for transportation needs as well. It invests our own local and regional tax dollars in the park system, increasing the public value, and stretches those state legacy dollars by matching each dollar that's invested into the system through the investments that we make on a local level, and also the investments that we try to seek out through the federal system, whether that's for trail improvements, whether that's for park projects, whatever it may be. With 64% of the state revenues being generated in the metro area, it reinvests only a portion of the revenues where those dollars are originated. It's sending the money back to where it's invested, where those dollars are being raised through the sales tax system. Our projects are shovel-ready. We're ready to go. They've been planned. It's just a matter of implementing that long-range plan that's been developed by the Metropolitan Council. And again, it's a tremendously popular system. We saw 38 million visits last year. I think the figure that we've often cited is that only the Mall of America has more visitation than the Metro Regional Park system. And when you look at the growth, we've increased our visitation 15% since 2004. So in closing, the Metro Regional agencies are a good investment for the Park and Trail Legacy Funds. We support, as Metro agencies, the Governor's recommendation of 42% for the DNR, 42% for the Metro Regional Park System, and a statewide grants program for all agencies at 16%. We've shown that we are able to operate a system. We've been there. We've been around for 37 years in existence. We're established as the state park system in the metropolitan area, and we want to continue that partnership with the state in providing those services within the metropolitan area and serving both our residents of the Seven County Metro, but also Minnesota as a whole. We've been successful in delivering high-priority projects that preserve the best of the best lands and provide the most popular recreational activities. We've developed a contemporary 2030 vision plan that responds to public needs and it is in line with the ideas that were set aside in the legacy plan that was presented earlier today. And again, we've demonstrated political, public, and financial accountability since our creation back in 1974. Again, thank you for allowing us this time to present our position, and we'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, appreciate your words. And now, members, it's time for our lightning round. Public television.
You'll be right here in case it doesn't work.
Mr. Straczynski, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Thank you again for having public television back to talk to you about our legacy request. I have with me today, I represent the Minnesota Public Television Association, and I have with me today Diane Steinbach, who will make the presentation about our ask. She's the executive producer at Twin Cities Public Television. She's the hands-on person. When stuff that you see on television and Minnesota Originals, that's Diane's handiwork. She's the person behind all of it. I just want to draw your attention quickly to the handout we presented this afternoon. Should be in your packets. Looks like this. And the first page, the front of the handout, really recaps what we did this past year, past biennium, with the dollars. I just want to let you know that what we did with, we didn't supplant, this is new. We created 40 new jobs. That's the latest number, 40 new jobs and $2 million payroll last year. We reached 100% of the public in Minnesota through our television stations. It was about a 59 cents per capita average to do legacy funding last year. You know, and there's an interesting statistic that if you just think about this, per viewer hours, we had 600 hours available on television last year, public television. If you think about the eyeballs, every individual who's watching that takes benefit of that. We deliver those programs for about 0.0005 cents per hour viewed. That's a pretty good return on your investment. That's pretty cheap for all the wonderful things you do. The other statistics will speak for themselves. On the back side of this handout is certainly our ask. And so I'd like to simply say that public television multiplies, we will multiply your investment by bringing more money into Minnesota from national sources. We've documented that, and Diane will talk about that. And we also multiply your investment in us by driving business or viewers into artist studios, cultural events, and historic places. And besides enriching the lives of our viewers, we benefit countless organizations and communities. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Diane Steinbach, and thank you.
Ms. Steinbach.
And thanks for the $6.3 million last biennium.
You're welcome. And thank Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
And that's how I'd like to start. Thank you, Chairman Erdahl, and distinguished members of the committee. Let me say first a huge thank you to all of the committee members from the last biennium, but most of all to the citizens of Minnesota for passing the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. We just couldn't have done what we've been able to do in the last biennium without your help. And the mission of public television is to use the power of media to create conversation about ideas, to offer opportunities for lifelong learning, to prepare our children for success in school, and to create informed, engaged citizens. The collective staffs of the six MPTA, Minnesota Public Television Association stations, believe that with that power comes great responsibility. The MPTA is one of the best, most efficient means of communicating and informing our audiences around the state. Today, I'll just briefly share what we've produced to date and what we seek to accomplish in the future. And I'd also like to reference the report that we turned in. It was about a 50-page report that goes into probably more detail than you may want of what each of the six stations have produced in the last biennium with legacy dollars. And that full report was submitted on January 14th. The MPTA stations are doing the state's work, documenting the work of Minnesota artists, historians, and educators, and leaving a lasting statewide legacy for future generations. Part of what the producing stations have learned in this biennium has been that our legacy fund programs are making a difference. Through informal surveys and polling that we've done, viewers are telling us that they've discovered something new as a result of our arts and cultural productions. More artists are reporting that they've sold works or received a grant, and we hope that's the result of our broadcasts. All of the programming, 600 hours, as Bill mentioned, was produced this biennium, would not have been possible without legacy funding. This is evidenced by the lack of arts and cultural production and programming prior to the fund's existence. Before the legacy amendment, we were lucky at best to produce maybe an hour special or two a year. Legacy funding has created over 40 full-time jobs, as our handout indicates, within the MPTA, and that doesn't even include the freelance community that we engage and also hire to work on our productions with us. All six MPTA weekly legacy-funded series have been created with input from their advisory committees and are a true reflection as a result of their local community. By bringing the work of the creative communities around the state to Minnesota viewers on a regular weekly basis, our audiences say they've been motivated to buy tickets, artwork, and handmade goods from artists, performers, and artisans they were not aware of until they discovered their existence on legacy-funded programming. Educators are accessing our websites and using segments as teaching tools in their classrooms, and we're also believers in the power of partnerships. We've had a number of partnerships created with other arts organizations, I should say, nonprofits, and over the course of this year. And when we joined forces, for example, with the Humanities Center, we've worked with them this past year to create educator guides that can be found on our website that go with each segment that airs in our production. And I know the Fargo-Moorhead Station has been working, for example, with their local school districts and have teacher workshops and all kinds of educational materials, art education materials that classroom teachers are able to use. So we leverage the power of both organizations to the good of all, and we provide an even better return on the state's investment of funds and the faith that's been placed in us in public television by our audiences. In the first year of the last biennium, the stations hired staff, developed programs, built websites, and launched new programming around the state. Now we would like a chance to continue building that legacy of well-received arts, cultural, and history programs to provide an even greater return on the state's investment. And now I'd like to let you hear about the impact of MPTA legacy programming in a way that we tell stories best, through video. And we'll hope it works. Thanks, Mike.
Public Television Association celebrates Minnesota's art, culture, and history. Funding from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment is making it possible for the 6 public television stations of the MPTA to make an impact across Minnesota. We are building community, energizing the economy, providing educators valuable resources, and documenting Minnesota's history by making the arts and history more accessible.
The wonder of it is it happens on public television, so everybody gets to see it, and it reaches every household that has a TV set, so it's a very easy way for people to tune in and see what's happening in the state.
The MPTA has broadcast more than 600 hours of legacy-funded programs unique to each station's region, including new weekly series, performance specials, and history and cultural documentaries. The MPTA stations collaborate with viewers and experts in their respective communities to ensure that the content produced is important and relevant to their hometowns.
My art is trying to help build community by creating a beautiful place, a beautiful mural. And in that way, maybe the neighbors will paint their house, they'll plant a garden, they'll start a business. And so my hope is that it does help my community in some way or another.
Legacy-funded public television programs introduce the citizens of Minnesota to artists and arts organizations, small businesses that thrive with more statewide visibility. MPTA's legacy-funded programs have featured nearly 2,000 artists, historians, educators, and experts. 150 Minnesota cities and towns are represented by their local artists and organizations in legacy-funded MPTA broadcasts.
What I'm trying to do is show the changing cultural landscape. Programs such as Minnesota Originals, by showcasing exhibits like this and showing that art or public art is really a way of looking at culture. It's a way of looking at who we are.
MPTA arts and history programs are valuable assets to educators.
Legacy-funded public television programs are essential to me as a teacher because they provide me access to artists that I normally wouldn't have in my classroom.
Legacy-funded MPTA programming reaches far beyond the statewide broadcast audience.
I think it's really important that Lakeland Public TV is producing Common Ground and is going to air it online, and so that a friend of mine who is being shipped off to Iraq for a few months will be able to watch this episode and get a little taste of home of northern Minnesota.
With more and more Minnesotans watching, legacy-funded television programs are stimulating the state's economy.
There's a portion of the audience that's there because they saw Minnesota Original and they saw Allison Scott on there singing, and so then they go out and they park in a parking ramp downtown and pay for that, buy dinner, pay the cover, buy our CD. And so it's a kind of a ripple effect economically, not only for us but for the venues and the whole Minnesota music scene to make it healthy.
The Minnesota Public Television Association is dedicated to making an impact across Minnesota by building community, invigorating the economy, providing educators with valuable resources, and making the arts and history more accessible. We are preserving and advancing Minnesota's artistic legacy.
This legacy that you are establishing with this will be a wonderful record in time of what was done here, and people will be able to look back on it and have something to be very proud of.
March 24th, all 6 stations of the Public Television Association will have produced a half-hour program that will feature what they've done with their legacy funding. And so we will have, it'll start at 7 o'clock and it'll go till 10. It'll air statewide, and each half hour it'll be a different station half-hour program that's dedicated to legacy funding and what they've been able to do and accomplish in this year. But it would be an oversimplification on my part to suggest that what the MPTA seeks to do in the coming biennium is just more of what they're already doing. Part of our own discovery in the first biennium includes a realization of how much there was to do. Someone asked me at a press conference once how long we had hoped to keep the program going, and I said, we have enough content for 25 years. So what we've discovered, and it's true, is there are artists we've yet to reach, communities that we haven't yet reached represented and served, history we haven't yet captured, stories we haven't yet shared with Minnesota and the nation. So the Minnesota Public Television Association would like to request $10 million in the next biennium. With your generosity, we will be able to continue these programs in the next biennium. And what Minnesota will receive on its return on its investment is the expansion of the programs we've established, but have only just begun. So first, we'd like to continue producing the weekly programs, the Minnesota history and cultural documentaries that we've been producing this year, and to expand our education materials that go along with all of the programs that are being produced around the state to make those more robust. And there is also a PBS Arts Initiative that has been created in the past couple of years. And PBS has taken note of a lot of our programs on our website because, of course, everything is international now. And so McNeil Lehrer has aired a number of our legacy pieces from Minnesota Original. And I'm sorry, it's the News Hour now. I'm dating myself. And also the PBS would like to partner with us to produce a program that the Guthrie Theater is producing. We're working on that right now and hope to have that come to fruition in the summer. And then the last thing we'd like to build is a legacy library that would be a much more robust website that would have all of the video that's produced by all of the MPTA stations, because video files are huge, and so it really needs to have everything coupled in, you know, just placed in one place would be helpful to have that, so that all Minnesotans can access any of the legacy programs at any time. So with that, I would invite questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for your time.
Any question? Seeing none, thank you very much. And now, the Indian Affairs Council. Identify yourself with the tape, please.
My name is Jolene Shaptes. I'm the Legislative and Grant Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I can do this in 30 seconds. We've come to you guys before and presented on all of our grants and our feasibility study that we've done, and what our request for you guys is to continue the work that we've started. Chairman Lisi once said that you can never throw money at a you can't throw money at a problem without a plan. So we're asking for $75,000 so we can do just that. We've identified some of the barriers in the state to revitalizing our language, but we really need a plan. We need to figure out how we're going to do that. And so that's one of the things that we'd like to tackle with your support in granting us an appropriation to continue the work we're doing. We'd also would love to continue our grant program. Yesterday was the deadline for the second round. We had 9 grants that were delivered to our office, grant RFPs, and they just had to be postmarked by yesterday, so I'm sure we'll get twice as many as that, if not more. So we're really excited about that program. So we're asking for $550,000 in 2012 and $700,000 in 2013. And again, we're asking for an appropriation to our 2 immersion schools, and that would be done through a pass-through through our office, and we would oversee what they're doing with that money, just as we've done in the past. And the last but not least, we're asking for a 2.5% administration fee to implement all of these programs. So that is my request to you, and I am here for any questions or comments that you may have.
Thank you. Questions? And a fine job, Ms. Shaptes. Thank you.
She knows what lightning round means.
That's right. Thank you. And we have one more. I'm sure they can do that in half the time that.
Mr. Chairman, there's 2 of us.
Oh, all right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, AMPRS. And somewhere in your packet, there should be a handout back-to-back titled AMPRS on one side, and it's got a little bitty map of our coverage area on the other, and then a list of our stations. And in params at the bottom, you'll see KUMM, our 12th station, that does not meet the requirements for grants that are in the statutes, and they thus do not qualify for legacy grants. But we share our programming that we've developed with them, and they are that programming. On the front, on that column, we made this mistake. On the third column over under totals, second figure from the bottom, we screwed up. That should be $386,900 per station is our what we're asking. And I will turn this over to our president, Michelle Jansen, to make the formal presentation.
Ms. Jansen.
Chairman Erdahl, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michelle Jansen. I'm president of Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities, and I'm also station manager for KBEM Jazz 88. I'm going to edit on the fly for you all here, so I won't go through my whole script, but I want to thank you all so much for allowing us to use legacy dollars to create new and enhanced programming for the Amper stations. Thank you for inviting us here today to request funding to continue and hopefully expand our arts and cultural heritage programming. During our last update for you in late January on how Amper spent our legacy dollars, collectively we had produced approximately 1,600 legacy programs. That number has now jumped to 1,856, and all are available online anytime at ampers.org for free. And we continue to work towards including all areas of Minnesota in our programming. And Chairman Erdahl, you'll be happy to know that Meeker County is now represented by an MN90 piece entitled A Small Town's Identity Bound by Twine. While we've been able to deliver thousands of artistic programs on
air. We are speaking
of
Darwin there, aren't we?
Pardon me?
We are speaking of Darwin.
Darwin.
Yes.
Darwin.
Darwin is where the twine ball is.
Largest ball of twine made by one man ever.
In the world.
In the world. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl. I'd like to briefly outline our request and plans for the next biennium, and please keep something in mind. We have 11 different stations literally doing hundreds of programs, and today I just have a few minutes to outline everything. But I want you to know that every legacy dollar we spend is explicitly accounted for in the work plans we provided to the Department of Administration, and the Department of Admin must approve the work plan before we receive any payments. No legacy dollars are spent on general operating expenses or anything other than legacy programs. The Department of Admin, Ampers, and the stations monitor that. The largest portion of our funding and the largest portion of our request is for the creation of distribution of legacy programs that air on our stations. It funds programs like Miniculture, a 30-minute documentary-style program featuring Minnesota poets and dancers, and a youth radio project in Northeast Minnesota that gives high school students the chance to write, edit, and produce legacy programs, and our Ampers-wide partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society to create MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds. And now we just have to secure the legacy funds to make sure that those programs are available in classrooms as well. We need producers, writers, and reporters for these programs. In the last biennium, legacy funds help us to employ 83 people in some capacity, and we're looking to expand our programming, which means hiring more Minnesotans. We're hoping to put on at least 75 concerts, if not more, in the next 2 years, and estimate it will cost us approximately $480,000 to do this. And in addition to showcasing and paying Minnesota musicians to perform, providing Minnesotans with the chance to hear these musicians, some of these concerts will benefit local charities. Just this week, KSRQ put on a free concert in Thief River Falls that raised $810 for the Violence Intervention Project. It's also our hope to create more documentary. We've already committed to doing a documentary on the 1862 Dakota War because it played such an important role in our state's history. Stations are also considering documentaries on the history of mining, a look at Minnesota guitar and mandolin builder Lloyd Plant, among many, many others. Education is a key part of the Amper's mission. We'd like to expand it even further by creating paid internships at the college level to work on legacy projects, and we're hoping to create even more opportunities for high school students to get hands-on training. In your handout, you'll see a line item for internships and training. There are actually three great benefits to these programs: education, more arts and cultural programs, and once again, taxpayer dollars going back into the economy when interns get paid. There are many ways for us to distribute legacy programming. We want to get these programs out to as many Minnesotans as possible, and one way we do that, again, is through ampers.org, where anybody can access any of the programs for free. We also have Best Of CDs, which are very popular. We'd like to make even more programming available for free through CDs and download cards. And we hope to partner with the libraries again so that once all free CDs are distributed, they will still be available for checkout at your local library. That costs about $34,000 a year to do this. Technology is changing so rapidly that nobody can truly keep up, but we've identified areas where we can utilize new technology to maximize legacy dollars and reach even more Minnesotans with our programming. We need to make our websites mobile-enabled, improve our online archive system, and create a central AMPERS online calendar so more people know about these great events. Chairman Erdahl, members of the committee, we are doing exactly what the taxpayers voted to approve. We are providing art and culture to Minnesotans in a fun, interesting, educational, and entertaining manner. I'd like to ask that you allocate $4,255,900 to AMPERS for the next biennium. It's an investment in art, culture, and jobs for Minnesotans. Thank you.
And one final word, Mr. Chairman. The list in the back, all but the bottom three of those stations qualify for Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Those are dollars distributed by the federal government, dollars that Minnesotans have paid in taxes that we're bringing home to Minnesota, and we use these legacy dollars to match those federal dollars and bring our money home again. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and about public radio. I listened to it at the 5 o'clock hour when I'm in the car so I can hear news, and I listened to the commercial, and then I got both sides of the story, so to speak, on another commercial channel. However, I wanted to enlighten you on a county that I represent. It's called Cook County. It's in the very end of the Arrowhead. It's a very, very large county, of which a lot of it encompasses the boundary waters. There are no radio stations that are received in that entire county except from Ontonagon County on the other side of Lake Superior, from over in Houghton and Hancock and up in the UP. They come in very plainly in Cook County. Also, half of Lake County, which also consumes a big, large portion of the boundary waters, is serviced by WTIP radio, which is located in Grand Marais. And all of the warnings that people get, for example, when we had the devastating fire that burned up hundreds of thousands of acres up there, if you'll recall that fire, all the warnings and things are received by the people out in the boundary waters because they take an FM radio along so that they can receive weather and things of that nature. So, I mean, I know that there probably aren't other counties quite like the ones that I represent, kind of like their state representative, actually. And but I'm appealing that this is very, very important to a lot of people who visit the area and important to disseminate information up in that part of our state. So just wanted to let you know that. I don't know that there are many counties that don't have either a radio station or get some reception. I want to qualify that one other little piece of information. If you are up at Grand Portage, which I don't know if you know where that's located, but it's very close to the Pigeon River, which is the actual border, you can receive, as you drive through the hills, you can receive the Thunder Bay radio occasionally. So that's the scope of the radio coverage up there. WTIP does a great job.
Do you have running water and electricity?
That got really pretty decent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else? Well, King, this case is closed.